This is Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Ratchford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and UConn Health Orthopedic and Sports Medicine. Healthy Rounds provides general information regarding medical conditions and diseases. The information is not intended to create a doctor-patient relationship. You are encouraged to consult your own medical provider for advice that applies to your own medical care. And now, Dr. Anthony Alessi on WTIC, News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Welcome to Healthy Rounds, the show that provides you with up-to-date medical information and answers all of your health questions. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be back with you for a live program now that I have returned to Connecticut, and we will have live guests today. So it is great to be back in the saddle, as they say. If you wish to reach me during the program, you could reach me at info@alessimd.com or at any time during the week at the same email. And the reason I'm giving you that is because we have two guests this week. And first, we're going to be chatting with Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford, a frequent guest on our program. She's an ophthalmologist at the Ratchford Eye Center. We recently interviewed her, and part of that interview discussed, and I reiterated a little bit about it last week, was the problem with eye drops, right? People are using eye drops and developing a Pseudomonas infection in their eye. Some people have died. Others have gone blind. So with that, she had discussed it briefly with us. It was a couple of months ago. So we want to get a follow-up with her. So at around 11:15, Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford is going to be calling in. So if you have questions for her, send them on over now. Then, at the bottom of the hour, we're going to be joined by Dr. Joseph Dell'Orfano. Dr. Dell'Orfano is a cardiologist, and he's the chief of the Regional Cardiac Electrophysiologist Program. A lot of words. Basically, he is a specialist within cardiology that deals with arrhythmias and the conduction and coordination of how the chambers of your heart beat. And there's so much going on with that, especially with respect to atrial fibrillation, something we commonly hear about. So if you have questions about atrial fibrillation or something he's involved with locally here is the Watchman procedure, and we're going to discuss that, just get those questions over to me. Again, at info@alessimd.com. The COVID positivity here in Connecticut continues to show optimistic signs. We're down to 3.6%, which is outstanding. We're really getting down there, so very happy to see that. And we're starting to be able to loosen up a little bit in what we do and how we mask. But as I've mentioned before, we need to get ready for the future here. And there's discussion of a spring booster shot for COVID vaccination. And this is specific to Britain, actually, where they have discussed doing this. And in Britain, they are going to administer this. The people who qualify will be people over the age of 75, people who are immunosuppressed, nursing home residents. So the people at the highest risk may get a booster there. I don't know that we're going to see that here. What we will see is in September and in the fall, the rollout of another vaccine to be given with the flu vaccine. And so far, things seem to be working. So I think we're going to continue in that vein and really get things going. This day in medicine, April 8th, 1817, Dr. Charles Edward Brown Sequard was born. Now, Dr. Brown Sequard is well known as a neurologist, but also as a physiologist. And Dr. Brown Sequard, there is a Brown Sequard syndrome. And first of all, he was a Mauritian physiologist and neurologist. For those not familiar with Mauritius, it is an island nation off the coast of Madagascar, so off the coast of East Africa. He was trained then in France, where he went to medical school. But his contribution is so interesting because in the 19th century is when he postulated the existence of hormones, right? This is the first time we're hearing about hormones, right? So the things that work, your thyroid, your pancreas, all your hormones. And what he started researching was using extracts from these organs and injecting them to supplement a deficiency in hormones. So basically, he was the originator of hormone replacement and using actual substances and the existence of extracts from organs. In neurology, he's known for a syndrome that involves traumatic injury to the spinal cord, where you have loss of sensation on one side of the body and loss of motor control on the other side. So there's two different losses of function on each side of the body after an injury to the spine. That's called the Brown-Séquard syndrome. One thing in the news that I caught in my eye was our Attorney General, William Tong, is seeking to end discrimination in blood donation. This has been kind of a pet peeve of mine, and from the standpoint that we always need blood, right? We're always out there asking people to donate blood. But we have had regulations, antiquated regulations in this state, where we do not accept blood donations from members of the LGBTQ community, specifically gay men and women who have had relations with gay men. And the issue was, in the past, it was felt that these folks were at high risk for HIV. But that has changed, because we test all the blood. We test the blood for hepatitis C, we test for hepatitis B, we test for HIV. So what has happened is, with this discrimination of this sector of our population, they and the people who support them have not been willing to donate blood, which is something we need for so many things, not just blood loss. So basically, the attorneys general have formed a coalition of multiple states throughout the country. And it's not just, I know people say, oh, it's all the blue states, a lot of red states, if you want to call them that, like North Carolina in here, specifically supporting this. And that is because it's the right thing to do. So we endorse that. I encourage our Attorney General to move forward with getting rid of this antiquated relationship, this antiquated regulation that has really hindered the ability for us to get sufficient amounts of blood donation. With that, we're going to take a short break. And also, just as I mentioned, congratulations to the UConn men's basketball team. There's a great parade going on starting at 11:30 in Hartford. And these things are important. People say, well, what's the big deal? Celebrations like this are important. It's good for people. It doesn't have to just be sports, right? Parades are always a good thing, right? People enjoy them. They are a place of enjoyment. So I really support that. And even if you're not a basketball fan, it's good to go to these things, because they are joyous events. And we need to do our best to surround ourselves with more joy these days. So we're going to be back with Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford from the Ratchford Eye Center. We're going to be talking about eye drops and which are the safe ones and what you need to do to be cautious. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. He rocks in the treetop all day long, hopping and a bopping and a singing his song. All the we're back on Healthy Rounds. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be with you again on this Saturday morning. And we are joined today by Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford of the Ratchford Eye Center. Mary Gina, welcome back. I wanted to get you back on to talk a little bit about the problem with all these eye drops. And people are just nervous about using eye drops. considering the numbers are rising with respect to injuries and infection from eye drops. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure, sure. So, I want to reassure everybody that the majority of the eye drops are really safe, particularly those that are manufactured in the U.S. And companies that are pretty reputable are companies like Bausch & Lomb, you know, Alcon, Allergan, Johnson & Johnson. And particularly, you know, I want to, you know, reassure patients who have glaucoma, for example, or have, you know, a pretty significant dry eye, that, you know, they really shouldn't discontinue their eye drops because they may get into more trouble, you know, stopping the drops because they are medicine. They are therapeutic for eye disease. But you're right. There has been a scare, you know, with improper sterile manufacturing at certain plants. And Globa Pharma is the one that the FDA recently investigated, and they are located in India. There has been some breach in some of their sterile protocols. And these are, I think, between ones that are manufactured in 2020 and 2021. There's only two, Ezra Pharma and Delsim, there's an ointment that have been recalled linked to this particular breach at this particular pharmacy. Now, the way that you can get an eye infection and then it spread into your system is when there's a breach in the corneal epithelium. Now, the epithelium is the skin that covers the surface of the eye, and that's like your skin. It's your main defense against bacteria. So if you have a breach in that epithelium and you give yourself a contaminated eye drop, that's when the bacteria can set in. So there has to be a breach in the eye and then a contaminated eye drop for all these sort of secondary problems to happen. So I just want to make that, you know, sort of clear that, you know, for the majority of people, these eye drops are safe. Now, the scary thing about this particular outbreak is, as you mentioned, it's Pseudomonas, which is a more aggressive bacteria. It's not something that's sort of commonly around, but this is a pretty strong and aggressive bacteria, and this particular one has some resistance to some of the typical drugs that we use. And so in the eye, when it invades and we can't get that under control, you know, there's been, you know, several cases where people have had their eye removed because the infection couldn't be controlled. And then if the infection spreads into the bloodstream, getting access, you know, through some of the circulation of the eye, that's when, if you're immunocompromised, then you can run into more trouble.
So I guess one of the questions I have is, so we know that it's this EzraCare was the first one, and and it was a preservative free. At first you had said it's the ones that had that were preservative free that were really the problem. Is that still the case, or are some, do some actually have preservatives and are still presenting difficulty?
Yeah, it's anyone that was made at that plant. And again, there was some breach in the sort of some of the sterile protocols that these pharmacies have to go through to make sure that there's a sterile product. So there was some breach within that, you know, kind of chain of sterilization. So I think anything from that Ezra Care product is not safe. I think then you just can't use anything that has that label on it.
Are they still on the market?
No, they've been taken off. There were 16 states that had the outbreak. One of them did include Connecticut, but I have not seen this drop in this area. I think a lot of them, they can get online if you order them. You know, you may not be able to buy it at your pharmacy, but they are, you know, things that you can get from an online retailer that, you know, those are where some of those come from. So, again, I think I would encourage everybody to check the label. Most of them are pulled off the market at this point. And the FDA did a really, you know, aggressive job in trying to figure out where the outbreak came from.
Perfect. With that, if you have any other questions, you could email me at info@alessimd.com. I'll be happy to get them over to Dr. Ratchford. Mary Gina, thank you. Thanks for your time.
All right.
As always,
thank
and
you
your
so
support.
Much.
Have a great Easter.
No problem.
Enjoy Easter with the
thank
family.
Thank you.
All right.
Oh, I
take
certainly
care.
Will. Thanks. And same to you, Dr. Lessie. Yep. Bye-bye.
Thank you. That was Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. And we wanted to get a follow-up on the eye drop situation there. I have a question that came in during the week. And this was a foot question relative to our previous guest 2 weeks ago, Dr. Lauren Gainey. And this is from someone who has neuromas on one foot and one on the other foot. And the podiatrist wants to remove the neuromas. And the feeling is that they would have loss of sensation in the foot forever when the neuroma is removed. So, interesting. I will get that question over to Dr. Gainey. But typically, a neuroma is a mass that's on a nerve. It's a very small mass, and it's not malignant, but it can irritate the nerve and cause pain. And the pain becomes so intense that you really don't mind the numbness, because the numbness, if it's on a distal nerve, like a nerve just going into the toes, which is where they usually are in the forefoot, those nerves, if you have numbness, you may then have numbness, permanent numbness in a toe or several toes, but it outweighs the severe pain. But the question was, is there an alternative? Often they get injected first with some anesthetic to see if an operation is indicated or an operation will help. So with that, that would be my answer, but I will get some follow-up from Dr. Gainey. And as always, if you have questions relative to our current program or other programs, we're happy to take them. We're going to take a short break. Then we're going to be back with my guest, Dr. Joseph Del Orfano. He is a cardiologist specializing in cardiac electrophysiology. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. I'm your host, Dr. Anthony Alessi, and it's great to be joined in this segment of our program by Dr. Joseph Del Orfano. Dr. Del Orfano is the chief of regional cardiac electrophysiologist program at the St. Francis Hospital. And basically, he's a cardiologist specializing in the electrophysiology, which is the coordination of the chambers of the heart. Joe, welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey. Listen, thanks for doing this. Let's talk a little bit about what is, in layman's terms, cardiac electrophysiology.
In layman's term, I'm the electrician of the heart. We're all cardiologists, and then we do a little bit of extra training, or a lot of extra training, and we primarily treat heart rhythm problems. So the heart as a pump runs on electricity, and anything that messes up the wiring of the heart, that's something that we get involved with.
Okay. And so what are your tools as a cardiac electrophysiologist, as an electrician? We know what an electrician has for tools. What are some of the tools you use?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, in figuring out a problem, we talk to people and what the symptoms are. We look at the EKG, which is the an electrical recording. It's very common, so I'm sure everybody in the audience has had an EKG at one time or another. But that's an electrical recording of their hearts of their heart that's made from outside the chest. And then we have other recording devices that can record heart rhythms over the course of a month. And then tools for treating electrical abnormalities include pacemakers, defibrillators, ablation catheters, imaging techniques. So we have a lot of high-tech and low-tech, ranging from, like I said, talking to people to putting wires inside the heart and freezing areas of the heart, causing problems.
So let's talk about some of the arrhythmias, and specifically atrial fibrillation. How common is atrial fibrillation?
So it's very common. The estimates are that it affects about 2.7 million people currently in the U.S., and it's estimated that over 12.1 million people will have it by 2030. I like to kind of think about it as the arthritis of the heart. It's thing that gets more prevalent as we get older. And unfortunately, that's one risk factor for atrial fibrillation that we can't really control, right, is getting older. But it is something that affects us as we get older more commonly than younger folks, although we certainly see it in young people as well.
How would you describe atrial fibrillation as opposed to other arrhythmias?
Normally, every heartbeat is an electrical event in the heart. We have a group of cells that are basically act like a pacemaker. They set the rhythm and they send out the electrical charge every heartbeat. AFib is just electrical chaos in the top chambers. It's like sparks going off all over the place. And everywhere there's a spark in the top chamber of the heart, the muscles around it kind of twitch. So instead of the top chambers squeezing nicely and pushing blood through into the bottom chambers, in atrial fibrillation, the atria, the top chambers are almost kind of like wiggling or twitching and not really pumping uniformly or pumping in a coordinated fashion like they're supposed to.
So you said we see it more as we get older. Are there other risk factors other than getting older? I mean, that's basically the good news and the bad news. The bad news is you have atrial fib. The good news is you've lived long enough to get it. Are there other risk factors for atrial fibrillation that people might be able to avoid?
And that's important. The avoidable risk factors, the classic ones would be high blood pressure, diabetes, being overweight, actually smoking and alcohol use, sleep apnea. And these are kind of the modifiable risk factors, things that you can actually do something about.
Who do we see it in? Is it more in men? Is it more in women? Are there particular ethnic groups that are more prone to atrial fibrillation?
It's said to be more common in women than men, and it's more commonly seen in people of European descent. Statistically, we see it in a lot of our patients and again, like I said, young or old, but predominantly female and European descent.
How do you know you have it? I mean, what are the symptoms that you're typically going to see?
The symptoms really vary. The classic symptom would be the sensation of a racing heart or palpitations, meaning feeling an irregular heart rhythm. Some people feel out of breath. Some people feel chest discomfort or tightness. Some get dizzy. There are people who feel nothing at all. In fact, one of my more famous patients is an Ironman athlete, and he's in atrial fibrillation all the time. We have other patients who, once they're in AFib, they can't get out of bed because they have symptoms. So those are ways you might know you're in atrial fibrillation. And once you've had it, you kind of identify what it feels like. So I have patients who never knew they were in AFib, but now that they know the diagnosis, they say, aha, that's what, like, all right, now I know what AFib is. And another great way, you asked me about tools. One of the best tools that we have nowadays would be an Apple Watch or a cardiac monitor. These are devices that hook up to your smartphone that can actually record your heart rhythm and tell you if you're in AFib or in normal rhythm.
Are they that accurate?
That's been very helpful. Oh, yes. It's an EKG. It is a legitimate medical EKG that you're taking. It's one lead, or in the case of the cardia, you can actually get six chest leads recorded. But it's very accurate. And the algorithms detecting AFib are quite good.
Let me go back to your Ironman athlete. So... How does that come about? I mean, how does a diagnosis like that come? Now, I've heard of people with atrial fibrillation. I had a colleague who I was with the other day, and he had to stop drinking coffee because he had an episode of AFib, and he felt the palpitations in his chest. So in an Ironman athlete, right, and for those unfamiliar with Ironman, it's a triathlon, so it involves swimming, biking, and running. So these are really putting your body to some level of stress that's outside the normal range. How does someone who's put themselves through that level of stress not know that they're in atrial fibrillation or having a cardiac arrhythmia?
So this fella is a great example for a few concepts. There are people who are completely oblivious to their heart rhythm disturbance and can walk into the office with a heart, you know, with AFib and not know they're in it. And he was one of them. But fortunately for him, his heart rate was normal. There are people who walk in with a heart rate of 150 beats a minute and don't even know they're in trouble. And that can be dangerous because a fast heartbeat for too long can actually weaken your heart muscle and cause congestive heart failure. So some people have no symptoms at all when they're in atrial fibrillation. Now, the other point about this gentleman is that elite athletes, there's some literature to suggest that can put you at risk for atrial fibrillation, really super competitive elite type of athletes. So exercise is good, but like a lot of things, too much exercise can have some harmful effects on the heart. And, you know, I'm not certainly saying don't compete in triathlons and Ironman, but sometimes you have to be cautious with that level of exercise as well.
You know, I've never heard that. So do you think that's true? I mean, do you see that commonly in elite athletes? Because I treat a lot of elite athletes and rarely see that they're in atrial fibrillation. I always thought there might be a genetic component to it or something of that nature in an athlete.
There may be. There are some studies that show high volume of endurance exercises can increase the risk of AFib. The risk of AFib in athletes is about 5 times higher than in normal folks. Now, you ask me if I see a lot of elite athletes. No, not at all. The patients I see are you know, coming to me with heart trouble, and most of them are not elite athletes. But we do see folks, you know, we do see a small number, and certainly not what you see. And so my population is a little bit biased because they're coming to me already with a heart rhythm problem. But there are studies which show that there's, you know, a higher risk of developing AFib in elite athletes.
Wow. Okay. So one of the problems we have, since we're on the subject of elite athletes, when we see atrial fibrillation in an elite athlete, especially someone who participates in a contact sport like football, hockey, and things such as this, several have presented with their first stroke, actually, and found to have atrial fibrillation as the first sign of it. So I have actually two questions for you. How often is the atrial fibrillation discovered after an event of some type, like a stroke or a TIA?
First of all, about 1 in 5 strokes are associated with AFib. It really increases the risk of stroke dramatically, and so much so that if you've had a stroke and we don't know the cause of stroke, we actually start actively looking for AFib because that's treatable, right? If you have AFib, the way to prevent a stroke that's been proven over and over and over again is to use a blood thinner.
Right.
And that really reduces the risk of stroke. So your question as to, you know, if you have a stroke, how often is it AFib? I mean, it can be, you know, a third of the time we actually find AFib in those patients and are able to treat them. But the looking for it is difficult. We put a heart monitor on them for a month, but of course, these may be rare events and we get nothing. And then we actually have implanted monitors we put under the skin that last for 2 to 3 years, and that can detect atrial fibrillation. Once we detect it, of course, we have something we can treat with a blood thinner.
Wow. I actually didn't even realize it was that high a percentage. I mean, we're talking 20 to 30%.
Yeah.
All right. So we've all seen people who go on a blood thinner, right? They're using Coumadin or one of the newer NOACs and things like this. But, you know, being on a blood thinner, Well, first of all, what are the blood thinners that they use? Is aspirin still acceptable? Aspirin, Plavix, Coumadin? What do we use for blood thinners? Because then we're going to get to the next stage of this.
Right. When somebody has AFib, stroke risk is absolutely number one, the thing that we have to worry about. And the only proven treatments are blood thinners. The classic gold standard is Coumadin or warfarin, as you mentioned. That's the medicine that you have to get your blood tested for. You have to keep, you know, make sure your blood test is not too low or not too high. And people end up going to get their blood tested once a month or even more when they're on this drug. It is 100%, you know, been shown to be effective at preventing a stroke. Aspirin, on the other hand, has never been shown to be effective at preventing a stroke from atrial fibrillation. So we actually don't use it at all. There is an exception, and that's, you know, if we talk about a device called the Watchman device, those folks are left on aspirin. But in general, aspirin does not improve your risk of stroke. The newer blood thinners, which have been out now for many years, what you referred to as NOACs, which stands for novel oral anticoagulants, those people will recognize them immediately because they're on TV all the time. It's Eliquis or Xarelto, Pradaxa, and so forth. And Eliquis and Xarelto, at least in our neck of the woods, are the two most popular ones. These are great because you could just take them and not have to worry about blood tests, and they work as well, if not, than warfarin. So they absolutely prevent the risk of stroke, and they have low risk of bleeding. But there's the rub, is that all the blood thinners come along with the risk of bleeding as well.
So let me get back to the athlete analogy. So in a contact sports athlete, right, we always run into this problem of they have AFib. You really can't put them on Coumadin or even a NOAC in particular.
Right.
You know, we try to cardiovert them, obviously, and see if that helps. But what's the alternative?
So if for whatever reason you can't take a blood thinner and you have to take a blood thinner, let me take one step back. If you have AFib, you don't absolutely have to be on a blood thinner for life. There are certain risk factors that increase your risk of stroke that warrant a blood thinner. So if you're a man over 75 or a female over 65, or if you have high blood pressure, diabetes, or if you've had a stroke before, or vascular disease, all of these things weigh into the decision-making as to whether you need a blood thinner or not. So if you have a young person with atrial fibrillation and no other disease, they actually, their risk of stroke is so low that you're not going to improve matters with a blood thinner. But if you have somebody who has to be on a blood thinner for long-term prevention of a stroke, the alternative is to use this device called the Watchman device, which is implanted into the heart, and it actually works as well as warfarin in preventing a stroke.
Wow! So, you know, when this first came out, the Watchman, there was some hesitancy, I guess, on recommending it because was it going to be as effective? So, can you talk about a little bit more about how effective the Watchman procedure has been? And can you describe for our listeners what is the procedure?
Absolutely. So the concept of the Watchman is that there's this little pouchy thing on the top left of your heart called the left atrial appendage. Left atrial appendage is literally an outpocketing of the heart, and that's where most of the blood clots tend to form in atrial fibrillation. I say most, not all. So if you have no left atrial appendage, you still have, you know, a smaller risk, but you've actually mitigated most of the risks. So the idea is I put a little cork in that appendage and seal it off, and you can't form a blood clot anymore. So the cork in this case is the Watchman device, and that's a little bit of a flexible, springy cork, and we bring that into the heart through a long tube called the catheter, and it's done under anesthesia, it's done under x-ray, but it only takes about an hour or less to put this thing in. There's no open heart surgery and nothing being cut. It's just one little IV in your leg, actually not a big IV, but it's an IV in your leg and then we run into your heart, and we leave this behind in the left atrial appendage and let it heal up. If successful, that and it is 95% of the time, patients can come off their blood thinner. Now, why don't we just use this on everybody? It's actually approved as a second-line treatment, so it's only used for people who can't take long-term anticoagulation and they need it. Why is that? Well, it's a procedure. There are some risks, although the risks in the latest generation are really low. They're less than 0.5% for anything going wrong. But as it stands now, the FDA approval for it is second-line treatment for people who need blood thinners but can't take it. Just like your athletes, if there was somebody who needed to be on one and they couldn't take it because of lifestyle reasons, you know, we have downhill skiers, for example, who don't want to be on that because of their risk, and that they would be eligible to have a Watchman put in.
So when you put it in, is it going in through the groin or is it going in through the arm? How do you get access to it?
We go in through the groin, the biggest vein that allows us that can accommodate the equipment. Usually I go in the patient's right groin. We numb it up, but of course our patients are under deep anesthesia for this. And it's really just we put a big IV into that vein, and through that IV we could put past the equipment. And we just slide it up through one of the big veins that the heart. You know, I tell people it's just like passing wires through a conduit, and we watch it go up under X-ray, and then we're able to get into the heart and finally access the left atrium of the heart. And then we're doing this under X-ray, and we also have an ultrasound probe that's already in place, and that probe is actually passed down your throat, so it's sitting right behind the heart, giving a crystal clear picture of the inside of the heart. So I could see exactly where my wires are, and I could see exactly what I'm doing.
Risks from the procedure? Because I got to tell you, so far, Joe, this has sounded like something I would rather have than being on long-term anticoagulation.
Yep. And again, that's there are risks. The risks initially were a little bit higher when they first came out, but they're on their next generation device, which is much softer and much safer, and so their data shows, and same with ours, you know, that we've been doing it, less than 1%. Actually, the number is 0.5% risk. Their latest trial shows a very low low complication rate. So what could go wrong? Well, I'm sticking a big tube into your vein, so you could bleed out of that. I'm instrumenting the heart, so you could bleed around the heart, or we could cause a perforation. That these things are complications that sound dramatic, but they're something we can fix if it ever happens. There's also times where the Watchman won't fit. It's not like one size fits all, and some people have different shaped appendages, and you can't actually fit the device in. So it's not something that everybody can get done. And it's certainly, like I said, it's not indicated as your first line approach to prevent a stroke. It's always blood thinners are first line, but this is a great alternative when you can't take a blood thinner.
Joe, thank you. Thank you for your time, and thank you for everything you do for our community. And we're going to be following this over time and see
Excellent.
How it moves along. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
All right. We're going to take a short break, then we're going to be back to wrap things up. You're listening to Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080. We're back on Healthy Rounds. I want to thank my guests today, Dr. Joseph Dell'Orfano and Dr. Mary Gina Ratchford. As always, thanking Kevin Corza, who's been on the board today, and Jeff Chandler in charge of sales and marketing. With that, I want to wish everybody a happy Easter tomorrow to really celebrate with family. And if you are given the opportunity, please show some kindness to others. If we learn anything during this Lenten season and Easter, maybe we should all just take time to be a little bit kind to our neighbors and friends. With that, next up on WTIC is Law Talk with Attorney John Matulis. Until next week, this is Dr. Anthony Alessi. Please stay healthy.
This has been Healthy Rounds with Dr. Anthony Alessi, sponsored by St. Francis Hospital, Rochford Eye Center, Hartford Healthcare, MD Advantage, and Yukon Health Orthopedics and Sports Medicine. Be sure to tune in next Saturday morning at 11 for more Healthy Rounds on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.